Welcome to In the Weeds with Nicole Asquith, exploring the way culture shapes our relationship to the natural world.
And this was the guest cottage for the two mansions.
Not too bad.
Yeah, but that was in the days when, you know, you went around by horse and carriage. Mm-hmm. And when you visited for like a week or 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm. That's violist Judy Nelson from the New York Philharmonic. I visited her at her home outside of Hudson, New York. She lives in a charming old Victorian.
I can go show you the best reading nook.
That sounds very nice.
The best.
Her practice room looks out on a pond with a resident heron that Judy likes to watch through binoculars. The visit brought back childhood memories of country houses where my aunt, who is a concert pianist, and her musician friends would gather. One summer, I remember falling in love with a trumpet player. I expressed my devotion with the gift of a rotten egg. I must have been all of 6 or 7. Anyway, before we delve into this episode, I should mention that this is a companion to my last episode with violin maker Brian Skarstad. I've been trying to learn more about the connection between wood and music, and by extension, between trees and humans. Brian brought my attention to the fact that each handmade instrument is unique.
Everyone is different. Everyone is different. It's like human beings. I like some and I don't like some.
I wanted to get the musician's perspective on this human-instrument relationship as well. Judy started out playing the violin when she was 11, but when she was in high school, she was given the opportunity to play a different instrument.
The violist of the Philadelphia Quartet, whom I got to know, was always trying to get me to switch. And I said, no, I'm a violinist. But then the summer after my first year of college, I was playing in a little tiny chamber orchestra, and we had 6 violins and 2 violas, and one of the violas had a prior commitment during part of our little summer series. And they said, well, who can play the viola? And I said, well, I can read the clef. I can play viola. So one of the violinists lent me this little tiny viola, 14 and a half inches, barely bigger than a violin, which was actually pretty good. It was probably quite a bit better than the violin that I was playing on. And from the minute that I set bow on string, it was like, oh, my voice. This is the right voice. And my sound on the violin was really problematic. It was tended to be scratchy and thin, and my vibrato was sort of sounded like a mosquito nearby. It was just, I had a late start and poor training. And somehow the viola was more forgiving. And so I was able to just pull what sounded to me like this rich, chocolatey sound that I just adored. So I played the viola for a couple of weeks. And then I was actually preparing for my first solo violin recital at my high school violin teacher's house. That was a month away. So I gave the viola back and get this thing away from me. And went back to the violin and practiced like crazy and gave my recital. And the next day I went to the Philadelphia quartet guy, Alan Glitzen, and bought a viola.
Wow.
And bought a bow. And took my friend Crazy Sarah and my viola and my Rambler station wagon and drove out to Eastern Washington and parked in an apple orchard and sat on the tailgate of the Rambler and taught myself the first movement of the C major cello suite of Bach, which is like, you know, the absolute standard, you know, if that's the iconic viola Bach, that's it. And I went back to school the next week and said, I'm a viola major. Now what do I do?
Okay, I know. That's a cello, not a viola, and not Judy Nelson either. But we had to have a little bit of Bach. And that is the cello suite number 3 in C major. A little more? Thank you. Going back to Judy, I asked her to tell me about her viola, having a sense by now that there's always a story. And indeed, there was.
I actually have two violas that are identical twins, or almost identical, by a guy, Guy Rabu, who says Guy Rabu. And I met him when our principal violist, Cynthia Phelps, her viola exploded at the beginning of a rehearsal. She has a gas bar, which is the Stradivarius of viola makers. Strad made a few violas, but Gaspar was the master for that.
What time period did
he? Late 16th century.
Okay.
Like 1590s. Old.
Right.
Old. And for whatever reason, the soundpost must have been too tight. Or Guy has some theories about what might have happened. But at any rate, at the beginning of a rehearsal, there was this kind of ripping sound, and Cynthia yelped, and you could see the back of the viola torn apart. Oof. And it had cracked over the soundpost, which is the single worst injury that an instrument can have. It broke, literally ripped through the back of the instrument, and to repair it, she chose Guy Rabu. So Guy had the instrument for 6 months. I mean, repairing instruments is not a quickie job. You know, there's no make an appointment in the morning and pick it up, you know, that evening, because things have to be fitted and dried, and they have to be, it's a very slow process. Plus, since you're dealing with unique instruments that are 400 years old, you're kind of making it up as you go along. There's not like a manual with specs that you can look up. You're using calipers and various measurements and deciding, okay, so how thick was the wood at this exact spot? Should I replace, you know, what am I going to do here? So while he was repairing Cynthia's viola, he made a copy. An exact copy, down to like the distressing, you know, the coloring, the places where it had gotten beaten up over the years. It's smaller. Her viola is enormous. How she plays it, I have no idea, because she's my size, but she plays it 17 and 5/8, I think. My viola is 16, and it still looked pretty good size. 17 and 5/8 is pretty huge. So he made this copy that was 16 and a half inches long. And a colleague of mine, with whom I've been good friends since Juilliard, bought it. And the friend is a sort of deals on the side with instruments and bows and stuff, and knows a lot. And he brought it to a Parks concert. And I was like, oh, wow, that's really interesting. What is it? And he said, a Guy Rabu made it when he was, it's a copy of Cynthia's. And I was astonished. I mean, it had a really dark, chocolatey sound, but very good projection. And I said, wow, this is really, really interesting. So then I wasn't really ready to buy another instrument. I was playing a different modern instrument. And then, as I recollect, the next year, Ken showed up with another copy, somewhat smaller, and basically handed it to me at the first Parks rehearsal. And I said, oh, this is another copy of Cynthia's instrument, a little different. And I played on it, and I said, oh, wow, this is really great. And he said, I know, Guy made it for you. Oh, it was like on spec without even...
Wow.
He just figured I would like it, and he was absolutely right. I bought it, and then so that I would have, I decided I would try having one at home in my apartment and one in my locker at work, so that I didn't have to schlep so much. Mm-hmm. But of course, that didn't work, because they're, even though they were twins, they were always different. Mm-hmm. They felt different to play, And one would be an adjustment and the other one wouldn't be. Mm-hmm. You know, it was very dry in the locker room, so the locker viola would be unhappy. Yeah, blah, blah, blah. But that's how I wound up owning two Guy Ribuy violas.
I read that violas, the sizes are more variable
yes,
than a violin.
Much right? more.
Yeah.
Yes. Violinists complain if a violin is a quarter inch larger mm-hmm. or smaller. We're like, you know, I mean, we can, our instruments go from scarcely bigger than a violin. What's considered a standard size is 16 inches body length. But then, of course, the string length and the neck length can vary.
And is the reason for that historical, the fact that there's more of a range? Okay, pause. We're going to be talking about the violin family here, so let's take a moment to recall what the three instruments in that family we're most familiar with sound like. Here's the cello we heard before, played by Colin Carr in the Bach Cello Suite No. 3 in C major. And here's what the viola sounds like in an excerpt from Brahms' Sonata for Viola and Piano No. 2 in E-flat major. And finally, the violin, with some more Bach played by Karen Gomio. So, I was saying, and is the reason for that historical, the fact that there's more of a range?
Yeah, the whole family started out from the viols, mm-hmm. V-I-O-L-S. So, you started out with, you've heard of viola da gamba, that mm-hmm. means of the leg, which was played like a cello, except mm-hmm. without an end pin. Viola da braccia, which is of the arm, and that's, braccia is the German word for viola now. And right. then the violin just kind of wound up being called violino. But the violin settled into a standardized size much earlier because it acoustically, there are reasons that Strad violins are considered, you know, kind of like the height of perfection of the string family. It's because the amount of resonating space and the string length are all really well calibrated with its pitch range. Viola is a fifth, you know, 5/8 of an octave lower. So to maintain that.
It's an octave above a cello, is that right?
The viola is an octave above the cello.
Okay.
But if a violin is 14 inches, that's the standard body length, to get a fifth lower, you would need a body length of 21 inches. That's not playable. And a cello would have to have a body length of 42 inches, which is totally not playable. So basically, the violin was designed very well, and everybody else is playing catch-up. And for a long time, basically, the theory was you played as large a viola as you could manage because it was easier to get a more dark mezzo or alto or even a baritone kind of sound. And most people want a darker, lower sound. They don't want to sound like a violin because violins sound like violins. You want a different kind of voice, chocolatey, darker. So people tended to play instruments that were, the modern makers were making instruments that were quite large and giving all of us arthritis. And meantime, there were makers who made enormous instruments back in the day. How they were played, I have no idea, because people were shorter back then. I think basically the viola didn't tend to play much. It just played like eighth notes while the violins were doing all the hard work. So a lot of those instruments were cut down in the 18th, 19th centuries. And so sometimes identifying instruments can be really mysterious because they've been so changed from the original. Then there are fake labels and, you know, all sorts of chicanery.
Yeah, the history surrounding individual instruments, fascinating
it,
stuff.
It really is. It really is. I mean, the fact that all the famous violins, like the Strads, are all known by the people who owned them and played them, you know, and it's just, it's wonderful. I mean, you mm-hmm. think, here you are playing an instrument that was owned by a French king and that was played by Joachim or something like this. You know,
it's just incredible that these things hold up.
Yeah,
the way they do.
It is amazing.
Yeah.
Some of the same themes that I had touched on in my conversation with Brian Skarstad reemerged in my conversation with Judy Nelson, but with a different inflection, the perspective of the player rather than the maker.
I think people have realized for a very long time that a violin or anything in the violin family is a living being. Mm-hmm. You know, it's wood. Mm-hmm. It's not metal.
Mm-hmm.
It's wood, and in the old days it was gut strings, so that everything was organic.
Mm-hmm.
And that presented a lot of challenges. You know, if you lived in a climate where it was cold and dry in the winter and hot and wet in the summer, like here, your instrument, you know, might be very happy in one part of that and unhappy in another, or just confused all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, there was no such thing as polyester and foam insulation for cases to protect the instruments. People carried them around in bags, in silk bags. Places were not heated and air-conditioned.
When you talk about it being a living being, one of the things that comes to mind is the fact that the wood doesn't just stay the way it is,
right?
The wood continues to age, and that changes the character.
Right.
I assume that that changes the sound of the instrument.
Right. This is
well,
one of the great questions that has plagued players and makers for as long as people have been recognizing old instruments as great. What is it that makes a Strad sound different or better than a modern instrument? And there have been cases in which people have played a Strad against a modern instrument and the modern instrument has won, you know, blindfold cases. But in a lot of those cases, the person playing doesn't know how to play a Strad.
Mm-hmm.
You play an old Italian instrument very differently than a modern instrument. It's more delicate. It can take different kinds of pressure. Lisa has a Cerruti, beautiful Cerruti violin. I think that would be a 19th century Italian violin that has to be really set up a certain way. And it's just very interesting. It's like, you know, she developed a whole technique of playing on that instrument that is very different from what you would use on an absolutely modern new instrument.
Interesting.
It's not universal. But everybody who has an old Italian instrument says, oh, yeah, I spent the first year getting used to it. You know, I learned to play it. I had to relearn. I had an old Italian instrument, a sort of a mishmash of an 18th century and a 19th century. There may have been two or three violas involved. It was cut down and had a different...
And sort of like a pastiche, like it was put
yes,
together.
Yes, it was a pastiche,
yeah.
Exactly. It was a wonderful instrument, but it wasn't very powerful. So after 5 years, I decided I needed, and it was also fussy. It's like you had to do everything right. I finally decided to try a modern instrument, a different maker than the one that I have now. But it was like, oh, I just put the bow on the string and move it, and the sound comes out. I can be
concept.
A little sloppy. And it didn't have the range of colors. And it didn't have that, I don't know, my Italian viola, I need to find out who bought it, because eventually I sold it through a dealer. And I know it's somebody upstate New York. I'd like to go visit it and see how it's doing.
She misses her old viola and wants to visit it, like you would a friend. I thought that Judy, as a nature lover, would be a good person to talk to about my abiding preoccupation with trees and music. But though it's obvious on one level, it's also hard to know exactly how to draw the connection. When I asked Judy if she ever thinks about the wood of her instruments when she's walking in the woods, she replied, "I mostly look at the trees and I'm really glad that they're big." Fair enough. But I felt some sort of insight listening to her talk about these instruments as animate, something you'll remember Brian Skarstad does too. Take this part in which Judy was explaining to me how the different parts of a viola fit together and what happens if something goes amiss.
So the first thing that people do when, like a luthier, somebody brings in a violin that's not speaking, as we call it, correctly, you see them pick up the violin and just knock, 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 all the way around the top, listening for a different, like finding a stud in the plaster, and then the same thing on the back. And they'll listen for a certain kind of, it's almost like a rattle. And if you find an open seam, then that's the first thing that you look to solve the problem.
It's interesting that you say speaking.
Speaking, yeah, right? Exactly. And it's not even, you never say an instrument sings. I mean, you might say that, you know, metaphorically. But when we're talking about whether an instrument is working and vibrating correctly, we say that it speaks. Mm-hmm. Just meaning that when you put the bow on the string and move it, that a sound comes out and it's a sound that involves the whole instrument.
Mm-hmm. So there are a couple things that come to mind with that. One is this sense in which the instrument starts to feel like, for lack of a better word, a person. Like it has some kind of, you know, like you said, you would like to visit the viola that you owned before.
Right.
Like, you know, it's an old friend that you would like to.
Right.
So that's interesting. So it seems as though you really develop a relationship with the instrument as well, the way that you would with a person.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, you know, I think that there are musicians who are closer to their fiddles than they are to any living human being. They might not necessarily be tremendously functional socially,
but
it really, I mean, you certainly spend more time with it than pretty much anybody else, and you're at very close quarters, and you have, it's your voice. Mm-hmm. It's your, you know, you're not depending on your larynx and your lungs to give voice to your thoughts. You're depending on your instrument, mm-hmm. and you're controlling it with your hands and your arms, but what comes out from the fiddle. And if the fiddle is obstreperous or unhappy and you can't make, you do what you usually do and it doesn't produce the usual result, it's unbelievably frustrating. Mm. And when it does, you know, there are times when due to it's happy with the weather or it's in good adjustment or you've got new bow hair and it's speaking really well, that feeling that whatever it is that you can produce, the fiddle can produce, mm-hmm. and that you have a symbiotic relationship where the better the instrument speaks, the better you feel and the better you can play. Mm-hmm. And the better you play, the better the instrument sounds. Mm-hmm. So it's a partnership.
It must be quite
intense.
Really
is. It really is. And it's most intense when it's not working.
It's your voice. Let's take a moment to dwell on that. Of course, the first thing that jumps to mind for me is that writing has been where I've mostly expressed my voice, capital V voice. And what do we write on? Paper. Well, used to be anyway. Whatever you want to make of it, it's certainly true that trees have been giving us humans the medium for our voice, our expression, for as long as any of us can remember. I'm sure that there's a mystery there, a riddle. At a time when we're cutting down more and more forests, and ironically, planting more trees seems to be the only feasible answer that we've come up with anyway to addressing the problem of climate change, I suspect we have to find a way of listening more closely to the voice of the trees. Maybe violins, violas, and cellos are a good place to begin. It's a thought, anyway.
So at what age did you know that you wanted to be a professional musician?
Pretty much from the beginning. There's actually a kind of a funny story. I don't know how much I've embroidered this, but I have a very, very vivid memory. When I was little, I wanted to be an astronomer or a mathematician, and I was swimming on a swim team competitively. And I was, of course, going to be an Olympic swimmer, you know, when in doubt, dream big. I was a terrible swimmer. I was really not talented at all. And I became allergic to chlorine when I was 10. And my parents said, well, now what are you going to do? And I had started playing violin like 6 months before in school. And I said, I'm going to be a concert violinist. I mean, this was so ludicrous. My violin was a piece of junk. The band teacher, orchestra teacher who was, quote unquote, teaching us to play was a trumpet player who had 3 months of string training, all the strings. But when they asked, that's what I answered, because I had this dream, like an actual night dream that I still remember vividly. I was standing on a stage, one of those, I guess it's called a thrust stage, you know, the one that sticks out into the audience, not straight across, the old-fashioned kind, with footlights all around. I was wearing a midnight blue gown, very long, you know, floor length, kind of flared, long sleeves, scoop neck, and I was playing the violin, and people were applauding wildly, and that's what I was going to do. And as it worked out, I wear black, and I don't stand up most of the time, and it's a viola, but it's pretty close.
Judy Nelson has just retired after 36 years with the New York Philharmonic. She would have kept going if it were not for a persistent wrist injury that makes it harder and riskier to keep playing so many concerts a year. But I'm sure that whatever her next chapter will be, it will be exciting. She's one of those people who's just bursting at the seams with ideas and insights. I hope you enjoyed the episode. We'll be back soon. Some of the upcoming episodes I'm working on are What Is This Culture We Speak Of? We'll look at wolves and fairy tales, the creation story in Genesis, and even the B word. Some crazy stuff. If you like what you've heard so far, please give In the Weeds a positive review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.